Today's October 3rd, 2015. This is Mobile News Podcast number 132. John Westfall is watching a football game. I know that sounds like a funny reason for him not to be here, but he is a fan, obviously, of different teams than I watch, and I don't watch many. But I've got Frank McPherson here, who also watches a different set of teams, so he's not watching whatever John's watching. So Frank McPherson has been a guest many times, and in fact was the original co-host way back when, I think in 2008. So today we're going to talk about some of the Google announcements that were made earlier this week. Frank, I know I saw a blog item you wrote about it, so you're really familiar with this stuff. Let's start with the phone. So Nexus 6P and Nexus 5X. What did you think about them?
Well, I was going into the event really personally leaning towards the rumors about the Nexus 5X. Okay. I am, you know, contemplating buying a new phone, and that was the one I was leaning towards. Coming out of it, I guess I'm a little bit more in favor of, think that the 6P might be something I prefer a little bit better. I first of all was disappointed with the decision by Google to not include wireless charging in either of the two phones. And I'm really disappointed with the 5X in the small battery size and the staying at the 2 meg of RAM. Battery issues, you know, supposedly Android 6 Marshmallow is going to have a feature called Doze that they're saying is going to really improve battery life, potentially as much as 30% or more.
Yeah.
But that's yet to be seen. What I'm finding, what I'm using as my daily driver is the original Moto X, the first gen.
Okay.
Which I've learned is not going to get the upgrade to Marshmallow.
Yeah.
So that's one reason to get rid of it. But again, battery life on this thing is getting to be problematic for me. And I think memory has been something I've been bumping up against for quite some time.
No, I got a question for you. When you first got the Moto X, was battery life a problem? Or is this something that has developed over time?
I would say that the battery life, I bought this, I'm trying to think, I had an HTC and I can't remember which model it was. Mm-hmm. I think it was three models ago is actually the phone I was using. I didn't buy this when it first came out. I think I waited a year and got it when they started dropping the prices to clear out for the 2014 model.
Right.
So I don't think the battery life was fantastic when I got my hands on it. Let's put it that way. But yeah, I'm sure, you know, particularly the number of apps that constantly talk on the network and do notifications, and I use a lot of them, are a big part of the problem.
Right. So let me just quickly review the 6P and the 5X for folks who didn't listen to the keynote or read the various articles. So the 6P is a 5.7-inch phone, so it's big, like the last year's 6, which is what I have. One of the big changes is the USB Type-C port, which... You know, I know why people want it, but man, it's just one more cable that I gotta buy if I get something like that. 12.3 megapixel camera, and starts at $500. So it's a pretty decent price. That's, you know, unsubsidized, of course. And the 5X is a 5.2-inch screen, 12.3 megapixel camera, also Type-C port, and starts at $379. Now, you know, I'll say this, having recently, and I get like you, I bought my Nexus 6 one year after really was released. It was a little bit cheaper. I got a 32 gig version for $500, which is not super cheap. Price actually dropped after that, but because I got it as part of Google Fi. And I'll say this, the 6 is too darn big. It will not fit in a shirt pocket with or without a case. With the case, it's just ridiculous. It's just too darn big. I mean, I can't put it anywhere. Now, on the one hand, it's a phablet, right? It's almost 6 inches diagonal. So I kind of stopped using my Nexus 7, which is too slow anyway now. That part is nice, but just the lack of portability, it's becoming a little bit issue, and I bought a belt clip for it. I went cheap, and it turned out to be not a good belt clip. I should have gone expensive and, you know, gotten something good, but I didn't, so there's that. I would strongly recommend folks at least consider the 5X, despite the battery. Now, I don't know about the, you know, the 5X's battery, but or the 5, since I never used a 5, but the 6's battery is pretty darn good. Again, this is last year's model. This thing will last me all day with, you know, with moderate use. I'm not a heavy phone user. But lately, because it's such, I like the 6, Nexus 6 so much, I've been using it a lot as for things that I used to use my iPhone 6 for, you know, like web browsing and things. It's quite good. But so you're leaning towards a 6P, and I don't blame you. I mean, you know.
Yeah, I just, you know, I'm afraid of that. Just that 2700 milliamp battery is not being enough. Yeah. Now, the other advantage that the 5X is going to have for battery life is that it only has a high def screen, a 1080p screen, mm-hmm. Which is going to draw less power than the much higher resolution screens that you see in the 6P and in a lot of the newer, you know, the Samsung phones and most of all the latest phones that have been released.
Right.
Which is really kind of a, you know, another interesting issue because, you know, one can debate whether you really need anything greater than high def on a smartphone screen, and there's advantages to not having it more than that, battery life being the chief of it when it really comes down to it.
Yeah.
So I frankly, if they would have, you know, if the battery would have been, you know, 3,000, or if they, you know, if they bumped the RAM up to 3 meg like the 6P has, I might have decided, you know, to have the smaller screen, yeah. The 5.2-inch screen. Which is actually still larger than my original first-gen Moto X, but as you said, smaller than the 6-inch 6P. I might have swayed it, and I would confess I'm still kind of going back and forth in my mind, but I am leaning towards the 6P at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that, you know, for folks like you and I who use our phones and our devices a lot, it does kind of consolidate things when you have one big phone. You know, I pull out my tablets less and less frequently now that I have, you know, big phones, basically. I should also notice a couple other things about the devices. They both have a fingerprint sensor like the iPhones do. And as an iPhone 6 user, I have to say that fingerprint thing is just awesome. Now that it works well. I don't know how well the Android version will work, but it is so much more convenient than typing in your PIN all the time. You know, assuming you do, and I hope most people do.
And that's an advantage because, you know, there are, as people will know, other phones on the market that one could choose here.
Yeah.
The Motorola, you know, Pure Edition is probably a very comparable one to these models. Another one I was considering. It does not have the fingerprint scanner, but it does come with a micro SD card slot, which provides
nice.
For storage expansion that a lot of the other phones do not have. And then if you want to customize it with, you know, whether it's a leather back or a wood back or different colors, you've got that Moto Maker as an option. So the Pure Edition is really nice. The downside for that is, since it's not a Nexus phone, it's not going to get the operating system updates, the Android updates, as fast as the Nexus phones. And for certain people, such as myself, that likes to get new software and new things faster rather than later, that is a compelling reason to lean towards the Nexus phones, which I had a while back and then kind of dipped away from when HTC and in the Moto X that I've been using, and I guess I'm kind of leaning towards going back to now.
Yeah, I should say that I'm in your camp there, Frank. You know, that's the reason I've had a couple of non-Nexus phones. I've had one non-Nexus phone. I've had the original Motorola Droid from Verizon, and that is the only... Is that true? Yeah, it's the only non-Nexus phone. I have Nexus 1, Nexus 4, Nexus 6, and the Droid was in between. The other thing I wanted to mention about these two phones is if you're interested in the Google Fi net phone cellular phone network, these two phones joined the original Nexus 6 as phone options. Now, you cannot get any other phone on that Google's cell phone network, so you know, up until now, we only had, you had one choice, which is why I have a Nexus 6. But if I were going to do it today, I think I would go with the 5X, despite some of the battery issues, or potential battery issues. We really don't know yet. But there you go. So the Google Fi, and I've got a few things to say about it a little later, and I'm going to be doing an article for extremetech.com about it. You got anything else you want to mention about the Nexus 5 or 6B?
Probably the other thing to add to complete the feature set, if you will, relative to these phones, is that Google did also announce what they call Nexus Protect, which is kind of like their equivalent to the Apple Care plan that Apple has for their phones. Basically, for $69, you get 2 years of coverage on the 5X, and that covers warranty and accidental drops. The price for the 6P is a little higher. It's $89. Again, for 2 years, the same type of coverage. There is a mention about a deductible on some of those items. $79, I think, was a mention of the deductible. And I didn't get a lot of clarity on what the deductible applies for, if it's just on like accidental drops and not warranties, or what that all was about. I don't know how you feel about these extended warranty plans. It's not something I've actually bought myself in the past on phones, generally because I tend to change, you know, get new ones once a year or every 18 months, if you will. But I'm thinking maybe with a larger device like the 6P, my chances of actually accidentally dropping it or doing something stupid, it goes up a little bit. So I'm kind of leaning towards that. I don't know what you, if you have any feelings on those types of
Yeah, actually, I have a mixed feeling about it, and it's mixed because I behave in a stupid way on this. So the way I do it, and you're going to probably laugh, having, you know, fell under Steve Jobs' distortion reality field years ago, I buy AppleCare for all of my mobile products. So MacBooks, phones, iPads, I buy AppleCare for all of them. And I have exercised it, you know, maybe this says something about Apple's quality control, but I have exercised it several times. I've had, you know, hard drives go out, and I've had a cracked case. No fault of mine. It was a known micro-crack issue in a case. I've had the home button simply stopped working. Again, this is a known problem. So it was all under warranty or under AppleCare, and Apple just replaced my phone. So I've made good use of it, I think. There are a few devices where I never exercised it, but, you know, it's okay. Now, having said that, I have not bought any extended warranties for my other non-Apple branded mobile products, including the Nexus 6, which I'm holding today. So, you know, take that as you will. Hard to say. For somebody like you, I would almost say, you know, you're not a poor person. You could probably afford to just buy a new phone if you broke one. You know, let's say after 13 months or something, after the original warranty ended. So, you know, it's a tough call. As I said, I am not a rich person. I am a poor person. I have a daughter in college that says everything, I think. But I did not buy. Maybe that's why I didn't buy the warranty. I couldn't afford the extended warranty. But there you go.
Yeah, the other thing is they also talked a lot about the cameras. Google, I think, has put a fair amount of emphasis on improving the cameras in these phones. I don't have the specs in front of me at the moment, but I know you're more of a camera person than I am. So you might have some thoughts on that. I don't know if the smartphone cameras are something that's real important. Obviously, the iPhone cameras have always been considered to be the best.
Yeah, you know, and I literally have several thousand photos on my iPhone 6 now. And I'll say this, and the reason why I say iPhone 6 is because every Android phone I've used up until the 6 has been a terrible camera phone. The colors have been inaccurate. It's been fuzzy. It's got, you know, chromatic aberration, it's got spherical aberration, it's just got all kinds of problems. And it being the camera and all kinds, including test cameras that I've had on loan. So, you know, I have not really used any Android phones as my daily camera. But having said that, the Nexus 6's camera is quite good. And if the Nexus 6P has a, you know, half-decent camera, or is as good as last year's model, it's a good camera. With more megapixels, you know, and, you know, it depends whether or not you believe more megapixels is better. But what it does mean for some people is you can crop. More megapixels means you can crop and get essentially a digital zoom. And yes, it's not an optical zoom, but you know, sometimes you need to crop for your kind of your aesthetic sense of what a photo should be composed, how it composed, and it wasn't quite right when you actually took the photo. That's a nice way to do it. So I think it's really important. It's 12.3 megapixels. You know, I'm not even sure what mine is. I think mine is like 10 or something like that on the 6, but it's not as good as the 6P.
Well, whatever it is, it's going to be an upgrade from my Moto X, so I'm sure it'll be better.
Yeah. Okay, next up is something that interested me a lot more than I expected to, and I have not bought an Android tablet since the first generation Nexus 7. So, you know, I'm obviously not, well, you know, I should say I haven't bought a new iPad since the iPad Mini, the original iPad Mini. So I haven't bought any tablets except Windows tablets, bought a couple of those. But I haven't bought any Android tablets in years, literally. And I hadn't planned to buy any Android tablets in the near future, but the Pixel C is pretty darn interesting. It's a 9.7-inch screen. It's got they call it a full-size keyboard that attaches magnetically and wirelessly charges from the tablet itself, so you don't have to plug in the keyboard separately in order to charge the keyboard, which is kind of interesting. It's got apparently a super strong magnet because you can hold it up from the keyboard, hold it up from the tablet, and you can shake it around, and apparently it doesn't fall off. So that is pretty cool. The Pixel C, you know, it's pretty close to that Android notebook I keep talking to you about over the years that I really would like to see. And I guess there are a couple now, but the only thing is it's not low cost. You know, it's going to be an iPad Pro range, but it's going to be an iPad Air cost range to get one. It's not a $300 purchase by any means. And it probably doesn't do a few of the things I want to do. Like, it can't record Skype calls to do podcasts like this. I probably can't easily, you know, do some of my blogging with it. Only because of the way commercial blogging platforms are set up for security and so forth. I can't use some of the tools that are, you know, we use kind of dangerously on our personal blogs, maybe. But what do you think? I found it really interesting. I think it starts at $499 and the keyboard's like $150 or something.
Yes, that's exactly right. What's interesting here is, you know, Sundar Pichai actually started off the event pointing out that the Pixel line is their aspirational kind of line of products, and, uh-huh. and what they mean by that generally is that they are purposely getting very involved in the actual design of the device so that they can influence it greatly and develop something that then can be something they can say to the rest of the market, saying, this is what we think the device should look like. So here they're saying, you know, this is a statement of what they think an Android tablet, the features it should have and how it should look. Mm-hmm. That being said, I mean, is the Pixel C that much better than any of the Samsung tablets or any of the devices that have been out earlier? Not so sure. I think, you know, as you said, the major thing that's interesting here is that keyboard. And what I think is even most interesting is the timing of the announcement. So what we've had here is Apple announced the iPad Pro that has a keyboard.
Right.
And now
soft
Google,
keyboard.
A soft keyboard, but yeah. a keyboard nonetheless. Yeah. They actually emphasize that along with a pencil.
Right.
And they're positioning it with those two pieces as a productivity device.
Right.
Then Google comes along seemingly answering that with their Pixel C. It's not ready, obviously, to ship yet,
right.
and emphasizing the keyboard. So they're kind of following instead.
Right.
And both of those
companies. And no stylus.
And no stylus.
Yeah.
But both of those companies are following Microsoft's lead.
Right.
Because Microsoft has had the Surface Pro out for a couple of years now.
Right.
And really, Windows 8 kind of invented, and I think, this whole two-in-one concept. I know Intel really has been had pushed it for quite some time, but you know the Windows 8 in its dual user mode, user interface, a tablet and desktop, really kind of created a need for this two-in-one and makes it a good fit. So Microsoft's kind of stumbled upon something here, it seems, and it's ironic that, you know, where they were so far behind in the smartphone and the tablet space, now you've got the other two companies seemingly reacting to something that Microsoft's done. You know, a lot of people, I think, are gonna be jumping up and down on that and probably disagreeing with what I'm suggesting there. But it is interesting, I think, for the folks in Redmond that these other two companies are doing something like that. And, oh, by the way, Windows 10 is a full operating system. So when you talk productivity, now you're coming back into Microsoft's sweet spot with Windows.
That's very true. Very true. And, you know, and not to defend Microsoft because they don't need it, but really all of this is, you know, the reference point is still Microsoft, but from 15 years ago. You know, if you remember, and well, I shouldn't say, I know you would remember the Windows CE handheld pros like the Vadim Clio, which was brilliant, quite frankly, as a transformer kind of device. It wasn't a detachable keyboard, but it could transform from a notebook kind of a thing to a to hide the keyboard away behind the screen, and it was a fat tablet, but there it was, and I thought it was a brilliant design. I still have mine, and then of course the original tablet PC, which had a couple of I don't know if they had detachable models, but I know there are the ones that did not have a physical keyboard that came with it. In fact, I think HP and a few built those. They're pretty popular. Compaq had one. Oh, I guess they're the same company. I can't remember if they were the same company at the time, but. So really, Microsoft has been trying this for 15 years now, and they finally got it right a couple of years ago with the original Surface Pro when Windows 8 came. The problem that held back Surface Pro is Windows 8 itself, and now that Windows 10 has fixed a lot of the issues that many of us had with Windows 8, I think it'll be good. And you know, speaking of Microsoft, they have an event coming up in a few days, what, October 6th, I think.
Yep.
So they'll be announcing probably a Microsoft Surface Pro 4 or something.
Right.
And we'll see what new things that brings. And if iPad Pro will have to catch up to it, you know, now that it's already been announced. And Google, I think, purposely tried not to play catch up by not putting a stylus in. We know they could have. You know, the Samsung, for example, has some resistive type styluses on their phones and tablets. So it'll be interesting. I don't know if I want to spend, you know, $700 or so on a tablet, on an Android tablet. I was just about to pull the trigger on iPad Mini 4, but I'm going to wait, I think. And I'm in no rush to get a new iPad or a tablet of any kind, so.
Well, I have one other concern about the Pixel C, and that has to, and it comes from the fact that I own a Nexus 9, which is, you know, the most recent Nexus tablet, though it's manufactured by HTC.
Right.
And this tablet has an NVIDIA processor in it.
Okay.
And I have to say, this tablet, in its implementation of Android, has been the worst implementation of Android I've ever used.
Really?
This thing is way too unreliable, unstable. I get lockups, spontaneous reboots, all sorts of weirdness. And I, you know, what I've been led to believe, basically in some posts that I've posted on Google Plus and seen other people, there may be an issue between Android and NVIDIA processors.
Ooh.
And if that is the case, Google's choice of NVIDIA for the Pixel C could be problematic.
Mm.
I know that there is, what's that? Oh gosh, my mind's going blank. There's the Shield. Who makes that? It's the gaming tablet.
Yeah,
it also has an NVIDIA processor in it. And it's chosen because it's a very high performing processor for tablets to do things like gaming and, you know, video and all that stuff. And you know, when I bought this tablet, I was really, you know, fired up by the fact that it had that processor, that it had seemingly top-of-the-line specs.
Right.
But this thing has just been problematic from day one, and they've released, you know, the Android 5.1.1 release,
right,
the most current release, supposedly fixed some of those things, and it did improve things, but it's still... got some memory leaks or something that just is problematic here. So, you know, that's my only beef and my hesitancy with the Pixel C, you know, is just that processor and to see whether Google has finally figured out what's going on with Android and in that and can get it fixed.
Mm. Well, I think it still doesn't have an official release date, so... We have some time for the early reviewers to let us know what's going on. I am not, by the way. Nobody ever sends me anything early. Hint, hint, Google. You can send one to Frank, too, by the way. And John.
Sure.
And John. But
one thing that will be coming relative to that is that, I believe, next week or this coming week, Google will be releasing Android 6 Marshmallow for the Nexus devices. So I am looking forward to getting it for my Nexus 9 and hoping that it comes, you know, with some improvements on this memory issue, performance issue that I've had, not to mention some of the other features that Google has been talking about relative to Android 6, like the Doze and now on tap and some of these other features I'm looking forward to checking out.
Yeah. The one problem, you know, speaking of things I hope they fix, you know, in my Nexus 6, Wi-Fi stack is a mess. It keeps losing Wi-Fi all the time. And I have to turn the Wi-Fi stack off and then back on for it to kind of recalibrate itself and get back on my network. And it's regardless of whether I'm at home or, you know, running around or whatever, it has problems with everything. So it's quite annoying. Hopefully Marshmallow will fix a lot of things in 5.1.1, which is what I think I'm running right now. I'm looking forward to seeing what the Pixel C is. I'm also hoping that Apple announces an Apple Air 3. But the rumors are that that won't be announced till next, or not, sorry, if it's announced, it won't be available next year. So both my iPads are getting, I have an iPad 2, not an Air 2. I have an iPad 2 and an iPad Mini, neither of which supports the new multi-window, multi-active windows. So I'd like to get something that supports that. So yeah, I might get an iPad Mini 4 and maybe save my nickels and dimes towards a Pixel C so I can get a modern Android tablet. Okay, next up is something I wasn't too excited about, but I'm trying to work up some interest for, is the new Chromecast, which is a completely different beast from the first generation. It looks different, it not plugs in differently, but has a different philosophy in what it plugs into, and I don't know, what did you think? I wasn't super excited about it, but, you know, I like the first generation Chromecast. I bought two of them, in fact.
Well, I jumped on ordering both the Chromecast and the new Chromecast Audio.
Oh, good. You can tell me why.
I got both of those devices. I haven't actually played with them. They showed up on Friday, and I just haven't gotten a chance to find time to basically set them up. So first of all, the new Chromecast, why did I get that? The main reason is that it now supports 5 gigahertz wireless network.
Oh,
so that will provide better network performance. It's also, I think, got some implementation of NeMo, which is the wireless, the kind of the beam shaping. So it supposedly will direct a wireless communications towards the access point or vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
So I have Chromecast on my living room TV that's upstairs from my access point.
Mm-hmm.
I also have one on a monitor in the basement where the access point is. And upstairs here with the first gen Chromecast, I do get some buffering occasionally.
Okay.
So I'm hopeful that the improvement to 5 gigahertz, not to mention the MIMO edition, will help in that performance. So that alone, given that it's a $35 device, seemed to be worth it. That's really mainly it when it really comes down to it.
Do you know if they put more RAM into the new Chromecast?
That I do not know.
Yeah, because that would help buffering, you know, a lot, in theory at least. There was an interesting academic study on Netflix caching. In different devices about a year and a half, 2 years ago, I think. And interestingly, you know, they basically said, look, there's a whole bunch of reasons why Netflix stutters when it does, you know, and it doesn't happen as much as it used to, but, and part of it is the network, of course, and also part of it is where does Netflix put its content delivery network caches? You know, if you've got one locally with your ISP, you're going to get a lot better streaming than you do if your ISP doesn't, you know, regardless of what kind of device you use. But all things being equal, it turned out that the amount of buffer allowed that Netflix allows on different devices, you know, based on its storage capacities, made a big difference in the performance. So I think at the time, and this is, you know, based on older technology, but at the time, Android devices has the least amount of RAM storage to provide for buffering, so it had the least amount of buffer space that it could be out that could be allocated safely, and it had, you know, the most issues. Now I don't think that's true anymore personally, but at the time that was the study. But anyhow, so interesting. I'm not sure the 5 gigahertz is gonna make much difference except to clear away, you know, if you're in a crowded spectrum area, you know, where there's a lot of people. And presumably most people will be on 2.4, the older stuff. But 5 actually has less wall penetration and stuff. So if you have a big home.
But that's exactly my issue. I have I've spent probably the last several months kind of troubleshooting my wireless LAN to really find out that part of my issue is I live in a condominium,
yeah,
and found that I have a lot of people around me on the 2.4 gigahertz network and covering the bands. You know, I mean, a lot of these people get devices that are sitting in band 1 or band 11. Those are the things that shipped from, you know, AT&T or Comcast or whoever, and they never change. I have enough that people were spread out all over the place. I couldn't even really find a very clear band. There's only, to what I can see besides myself, one other person that seems to be on a 5 gigahertz network. So that in of itself helped me. And so, you know, just throw out the Comcast aside, just my using my tablet here where I'm sitting right now, I just got an improvement by making the switch. I also upgraded my access point and got one of the TP-Link Archer C8, which, you know, is full all the way up to AC, so the most current spec, has some better antennas, does some beam shaping, some directing of the signal, and that's helped quite a bit too, just from signal strength and performance bandwidth testing that I've done. So, yeah, I think I'm going to get some improvement with that Chromecast on the upstairs. I'm going to keep the old one for the stuff I use downstairs on that.
Yeah, and at I think it's $35. It, you know, even if it doesn't have a huge improvement, you go, well, you know, it's what, 7 large Frappuccinos.
right. So the other device is the Chromecast Audio.
Okay.
And I saw your post on here saying, well, you know, what's up with that? And why would anybody get that?
Yeah, so why did you get it?
So, well, the obvious reason why did you get it is because it's so darn cheap, and why not is the honest answer to that question. But here's I think three reasons why.
Because,
you know, as you rightly pointed out, there's plenty of devices today, wireless speaker type devices today, to use Bluetooth for communication.
Right.
In fact, I've got a Bose SoundLink not too far from where I'm sitting right now that's how you communicate with it is Bluetooth.
Okay.
Hey, Bluetooth, as you know, has limitations in terms of bandwidth and distance.
You're right.
Okay. Chromecast Audio uses Wi-Fi.
Okay.
So you're going to have more bandwidth and you're going to have more distance. You know, distance will be less of an issue.
Right.
Now, I'm not exactly clear because one of the things that you kind of alluded to with the Chromecast is the original Chromecast with video, supposedly it actually has the smarts within that device to actually communicate to Netflix. So the streaming is going from the Chromecast to the internet to Netflix and back, and you use a phone or a tablet to set up that initial communication, but then it's out of the picture as far as the actual
data. It hands it off. Yeah.
If that is the case for the Chromecast Audio, and one would expect it would, then, you know, again, your performance is not streaming that data over Bluetooth. It's now streaming straight Wi-Fi to the public internet, and you're going to get just better performance, higher fidelity sound, and that type of thing would be the big reasons why. In Bluetooth, as you know, is a flaky spec. You know, people I think always have some issues with getting it to connect the way it should, pairing it up, and all that jazz.
Right.
Hopefully, that's much less of an issue with the Chromecast audio. So those are two things. The other big thing that is a feature yet to come with the device will be a software upgrade. Is the feature that will enable it to compete with the Sonos type of devices. Sonos, if people don't know, is another kind of wireless speaker and software combination. And its big thing is that you can set up a wireless speaker, say, in your living room. You can have one in your bedroom. Mm-hmm. You can have one in your basement. And you can have the audio synchronized across all those speakers so it's the exact same audio across them all at the same time. Mm-hmm. It turns out that's kind of challenging software thing to actually make happen. What Google has said is that Chromecast audio will provide that same type of functionality. And if that does, that's a big deal, because for a $35 device and, you know, somewhat cheaper speakers, you can get a functionality that up till now is only been available with more expensive Sonos devices. I think their speakers are in the area of $300 to $500, $600 a pop.
And that's my understanding.
And if you're
too
getting multiple ones to fill up a room, you're throwing down thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
Potentially.
Yeah,
I agree. All I know, I don't have one, but everybody that has them just brags about them endlessly. So I would be led to believe they sound very good and their functionality provide is very much worth it. So that's going to be the other thing I think that's got a lot of people interested, is seeing how well Google is able to get that type of synchronization working. So you could plug in one of these little dongle type devices into powered speakers throughout your house and get a Sonos-like functionality at a fraction of the price.
Yeah. You know, the one thing, and for $35, I think I'm asking too much, but what I was hoping would be announced with Chromecast Audio was some kind of Google Now integration, where, you know, I could say, and I got to watch out because I'm wearing my Moto 360 and I have my phone nearby. If I say, I shouldn't say it, you'll activate people's things. Okay, you know who. it which shall not be named. I'd like to ask it, you know, I'd like it to act as an ultra cheap version of the Amazon Echo. And it doesn't do that. Well, I don't know. Maybe it can do that. That's the question, right? So can I pick up my Moto 360, say, you know, okay, what's it? And ask a question, you know, what's the weather or whatever? And will the Sonos broadcast it over to speakers that it is connected to? That would be pretty cool. You know, if you could have an Amazon Echo type thing. It's, you know, one of the things I know, I don't know if you heard the past podcast, but when I was speaking to John Westfall, one of the things I was kind of talking out loud to John about was the possibility, the idea of buying my mom an Amazon Echo. You know, my mom, you know, lives by herself, and so she could just ask a question, you know, like, what's the weather like or whatever, and without even turning on the radio or TV, she could get an answer. You know, although, you know, she's one of those people that likes to look at a barometer and interpret it from there. So, you know.
Well, interestingly enough, one of the things we didn't talk about on the relative to the Pixel C that Google mentioned is that it's going to include one of those far field microphones that so, like you said, this thing hasn't shipped yet, so we're not going to see how that implements. But, you know, if you're going to have that, it's got to be used for something, right? So perhaps, you know, there will be some integration at that time with the Chromecast audio that would provide the type of functionality you're talking about.
Yeah. Or the Chromecast itself, you know, on video. And it would be pretty cool, for example, to be, you know, standing around, you know, something breaks or something goes, okay, what's it? Show me how to fix, you know, a faucet or something like that. Right.
Yeah.
And it brings up a YouTube video.
Yeah. See, the problem you have with the current devices is that they're really, designed to be hidden away either behind televisions or behind the speakers, right? They're, you know, they hang off of the HDMI ports in the case of the Chromecast, the video one. And so they're not going to be placed at a very good location to pick up, you know, to have a microphone and pick up that input. You really need something like, you know, the Echo that is looks nice enough that you would actually put out in a living room or something. Now, the device Google has, it's very close to that, is the on-hub wireless access point.
Yeah, which looks a lot like the Echo.
You know, looks like it, and has some other wireless features like Zigbee and some of the other wireless things in there that aren't turned on and actually implemented or used right now. Right. So that could be another connection here to what you're looking for.
Right. And it has microphones.
Right.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. Oh, you know, I was going to say something about the Chromecast audio. The Chromecast, excuse me. That it just dropped off of my brain cell. But maybe we'll come back to it. Oh, I know what I was going to say. The Chromecast comes in different colors. And my first thought was, who cares? You'll never see it after you put it behind your TV. But Google made a big deal that it comes in different colors now.
Well, yeah, exactly. I don't know why they do that, other than, you know, marketing, I guess. Yeah. I mean, different colored types of devices seems to be the thing that's attractive to people. So I guess why not? If it doesn't cost any extra for them to manufacture it, run some that are red, some that are yellow, and some that are black or whatever the colors are, and have at it.
Yeah. Okay, well, moving on, you know, a couple of small items, which I don't know if you care about or not. I found them kind of interesting. One is Google Play Music Family Plan. So right now, Google Play Music is $10 a month, $9.99, $10 a month. And I think then the family plan is, and I can't remember how many people in your family can be, but I think it's $14.99, you know, $15, and you can have two or more people, I presume.
Yeah, it's up to six.
It's up to six. That's a pretty good deal if it's up to six.
Yeah.
I'm grandfathered under the original $7.99 Google Play, called Google Access Music, I should say. And it's the only music streaming service I subscribe to. I don't have iTunes, whatever, music, or Apple Music. I don't have Spotify. I don't pay for Pandora. It's the only thing I pay for, and I really like it a lot. My wife doesn't listen to any of that stuff, you know, on her stuff, so it wouldn't affect her. My daughter does. I guess I could include her on a music plan. I don't think she has any streaming services. So maybe I'll do that. It'll be, you know.
I use Spotify. And I'm actually one of these crazy people that actually pays for it.
Actually, a lot of people do, I believe. But yeah.
Yeah, what happened, right, is it seems like the sweet spot for the pricing is the same with everybody. It's 10 bucks a month. Yeah. Spotify's got a very nice catalog.
Yeah.
The benefits that you get with the paying for it as opposed to free is that you can download music to a device and then listen to it offline. Which for my travels in some areas, more remote areas in the state of Michigan, where the cellular coverage still isn't the greatest, that's a useful type of thing.
No, I understand. Yeah,
but that's the only streaming service that I actually pay for. I do have music, you know, when Google first announced Play, and the feature is still there. Your ability to upload all your own music,
right.
I did that. And uploaded everything that I owned up to their cloud. So I stream that music when I want to listen to it. It's kind of a backup for me, actually, but it's still something that, you know, I can access through any of my Android devices. And so that comes in handy. And I use I'm an Amazon Prime member, so I get their Prime music. So that's a streaming service. I use that with the Echo quite a bit, but occasionally I'll pull that up on the phone as well. And then what I do when I do actually buy music, it's usually from Amazon. In these days, it is just the digital version. But if I bought the CD, they would put the digital version in your account, so you could still access it. So what music I have in my library at Amazon is strictly the music I bought at Amazon. It isn't my entire library, but you know, it was no work of mine to actually get it there. So it's there, and I use it when I want.
Right. Yeah, one thing I wanted to mention about Google All Access Music is, I don't know if it's a hidden feature, but I don't know how many people know about it, is if you watch music videos on YouTube at all, Some of the music videos will play on YouTube with no commercials of any kind if you have a Google All Access Music subscription. I don't really see a lot of those because I'm, you know, not young enough to really play a lot of the ones that would be affected. But that's a nice feature, I think, for people who do watch a lot of YouTube music on YouTube. Next up, next small item is that Google Photos got a product or feature bump. And the two things I found interesting were that it got private labels, which means you can attach your own labels to photos. Now, I haven't tried it yet. Versus, you know, just having Google attach labels. And I have to say, Google's label attachments, while not always correct, are pretty darn good and super useful. You can do things like search for red skies or party or something, and it will do its darnest to try to figure out which photos, you know, match that concept. And the other thing is it has Chromecast support now. So you can, you know, which I thought was kind of stupid, it didn't earlier. You can now show Google Photos over, you know, wirelessly over on a Chromecast device. I wanted to go back up a little. I wanted to mention that Google Play Music works on iOS devices just fine, as well as desktops so, and notebooks. So you're not limited to Android devices. And like Spotify, you can download music for offline play when you're not connected. Or even if you're just driving around, you don't want to burn up cellular data. You know, and who wants to do that, right? Speaking of cellular data, I want to mention my update to my Google Fi adventure. You know, when I got my Nexus phone as part of my Google Fi subscription, which started in August or September, I think. I was kind of disappointed, but not surprised that I didn't get the Google Fi welcome kit. I figured, well, you know, I'm kind of late to the game. This whole thing started in April, and I had to delay my subscription because I could not figure out a way to get around it destroying Google Voice when you transfer to Google Fi. So, and I have a kind of workaround. I created a second account, but I'll be writing about that too, you know, for Extreme Tech one of these days to explain my workarounds and what happened. But in any case, lo and behold, yesterday my Google Fi welcome kit arrived several weeks after my phone. Complete surprise. Did not think it would be included, so I'm very grateful that it was. And it's the same as the ones that others receive. It has a 6,000 milliampere USB battery charger, which is nice, very thin. And it's got headphones that has a friend jack, so a friend can jack in a second headphone. Which, you know, Frank, our generation probably doesn't do that. But I've seen my daughter and her friends, you know, like share, you know, split an earbud to listen to the same song at the same time. So I can see where, you know, younger folks would do that. And it also came with a case, you know, a thin case. It's not a highly protective one like the tank I have on my Nexus 6 now. But in any case, you know, I'm very, very happy to have gotten the Google Fi welcome kit. And it was a nice little addition. Especially since I paid essentially full price. I paid $4.99 for my phone, and the price dropped right after that. So that was kind of neat. And the last thing I wanted to talk to you about was your thoughts about, you know, there was a Business Insider. Well, let me back up. So earlier in the week, the new CEO for Evernote announced that they're going to have a fairly sizable layoff. I think it was a couple hundred people, you know, double-digit percentage of the workforce. And I said, whoa, that's really a shame. I really didn't know what was behind it. You know, I don't really know much about the innards of Google, of Evernote. I'm a user, not a business analyst of the company. Business Insider published it seemed to be well-sourced. If true, Business Insider published a company that says Evernote is in deep trouble and talks about how they spread their hands too thin and they grew too fast and, you know, kind of the usual problems we see with companies, but I was surprised, and they weren't converting their free users to premium paying users, scale that could support their growth. So, you know, as a heavy Evernote user, do you have any thoughts? I'm a little bit anxious about this. I use Evernote every single day.
I have a lot of information in Evernote, and I'm very dependent on it. And if the company has issues or what have you, that is going to be that's going to be a painful experience. I mean, there's no two ways around it. Okay. I think there is a lot to happen before that. You know, if that happens, I think there's a lot that could still happen that would, you know, the product could be sold to somebody if it, you know, if it goes that far.
Right.
I think right now you've got the pains that happen when a company transitions from a founder to another person, a CEO that's been brought in to essentially make the company grow up and make it profitable. And I would imagine, you know, the people that gave them the venture capital, the monies to help them exist up to this point are interested in seeing them become profitable and giving them a return on their investment. So I'm sure there's a lot of pressures there. I will say, you know, one of the problems I've had with Evernote is that it seemed to, 2 years ago, I would say, become distracted and started doing silly things like sell socks and you know, bags and a scanner. And some of it seemed to relate to their product, and things like the socks were just a fashion thing that made no sense at all. And it's, you have to kind of wonder, why are you not focusing on your core product and what it is that you're actually doing? And it was pointed out, I think, in that Insider article that I tend to agree, when he talked about their challenges of converting free users to paid users, that up until very recently, all you had for to be a paid user was one price. There was just one option to do that.
Right.
And in, I think, 6 months ago, they changed that, so there was kind of a medium priced tier.
Right.
So it was a little bit of a lower price that kind of stepped people up. And so, you know, you would think maybe if they had done something like that a little bit earlier, they would have things, they'd have better opportunities. But it's a challenge, right? I mean, people seem to want things for free, right? We all seem to be in the habit, whether we use Gmail or Hotmail or all these things that we use that we've really come to rely upon. We don't pay for them, and people tend to not want to pay for them, even if they're getting value out. Now, I've been an Evernote premium customer pretty much from day one, because I felt, hey, this company provides me something that's of value to me, and I want to see the company succeed. And the price is what I think was something like $50 a year or something.
Yep,
it wasn't an outrageous price.
Might have gone up, but yeah, it's under 100 definitely.
Right. And there were actual benefits, more bandwidth for storage and so forth.
Right.
From a feature standpoint, my only wish that I've asked for a long time is the ability to actually encrypt notebooks to make the data that you put in Evernote more secure. They provide an ability to encrypt information, text within notes.
Right.
And I use that, but it would be much easier. A step would be to simply be able to encrypt an entire note versus having selected and encrypt.
Right.
But if the ideal would be to be able to encrypt an entire notebook and secure it that way. Because, again, you're putting data on their servers, wherever they may be, whether they're using Amazon or Rackspace or somebody else. I assume they're using somebody's actual infrastructure.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's out of your control. And, you know, they've had some security issues, and any company that does. So, you know, I put stuff out. A lot of stuff I put in Evernote is clips from web pages and things of that nature. But I've got probably something like 7 years worth of that type of stuff in there, not to mention all the articles I ever wrote for Mobile Content Today and all that with stuff I wrote in Evernote. So, you know, I've got a lot of stuff that I put out there that I you know, enjoy having there and being able to search for. I'd be disappointed if that went away.
Yeah, you know, and boy, you know, I'm blanking on a name, but there's kind of a competitor to Evernote. It wasn't quite as good as Evernote, although it had its own kind of unique features that are, I really like it. I'm just blanking on its name, but
Microsoft has OneNote.
It does,
which is what I when I bought this the Surface 3 tablet.
Yeah.
I've started using OneNote now because of its integration with the tablet and the style in the pen and everything. So I started using that more. But it's not the same. It's nice. Evernote or OneNote, I should say, is a very nice product. I like the user interface, but it's not. It's all at the end of the day, each notebook there is a separate file,
right?
Which, you know, like a Word document or those types of things, you can manage them the same way. You can keep them on your PC or you can put them up on the cloud, whichever you do. By the way, you can store local notebooks, you know, locally on your PC and not sync them to Evernote's cloud. Right. I actually do that with some notes that I have that I really want to keep secure so they don't leave my computer,
right?
But that's yes, I know, and then Google has Google Keep.
Yeah, but that's really
I use that like a kind of a throwaway yellow pad.
That's how
yellow
I use it also.
Sticky note type of thing.
I use it the same way.
I
use it when I'm offline, and because Evernote is really not well behaved when it's offline. And so I use Google Keep when I'm offline. And I just need to take a couple of notes. So I'm standing in the middle of a large building or something. But yeah, so and it's funny you mentioned OneNote because I started off like most people. You know, OneNote was the original note-keeping program that I remember, and I just remember it being so overly complex, especially for synchronizing different PCs at the time. Not to mention no mobile devices back then. That I said, well, the heck with this, and I moved over to Evernote, and I never looked back. It's just a much better user experience. So I'm kind of hesitant to move back. I guess like you, I should take a look at it. I mean, I don't have a Surface like you do, but I do have some tablets that, I can fuss around on a bit and see how it works for me. Yeah, maybe that's
fine,
something I consider.
And it works fine on a desktop. I mean, it's, you don't have to use it on a tablet.
Right.
And
it came from the desktop. Yeah,
right. Exactly. So it functions just fine on a desktop as well.
Okay, well, in any case, I hope the folks who remain at Evernote do well and keep one of my favorite products up and running. I would hate to have to migrate yet again from an orphan product. I would, I don't know what the solution is. So hopefully they can make some money or figure out a way to make money and keep a very fine product going. I think it's well over 10 years old now. So, it's past kind of that couple of years, the unicorn kind of growth cycle, and maybe now it can settle down with a different CEO and figure out what to do. In any case, I want to thank Frank, who I invited at the last minute when John wants me to tell you that he's on a special assignment, by the way. So, but we know he's watching a football game and didn't want to tear himself away. So, but I wanted to thank Frank for accepting my last-minute invitation to talk with me about this. Because I read his blog about the Google announcements. And I said, I know Frank knows this stuff backwards and forwards, and he can offer some opinions and help me figure out what I want to do next. I'm going to have to go take a look at the Chromecast again now that I've listened to you. But we'll see. At any rate, thank you, Frank. And folks, this has been Mobile Views Podcast, 133. And somebody will talk with me next time, Frank or Jack or Sven or John, somebody. Right? We'll see you again next time.